Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, mythological beings, and monsters that I find therein, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode continues our journey through the Central American Mythos section of Deities and Demigods. Before we get started, though, I wanted to call your attention to an article. This is part of a series that I mentioned a little while ago that's over on EN World. And it's by Jim Ward, who is one of the authors of the Deities and Demigods book. In fact, he says that he was the primary author, basically, that he and Rob Koontz were supposed to write it together, but that Koontz became unavailable. This was brought to my attention by listener Glenn Robinson. So, Glenn, thank you very much. I did see some of the early articles, but I hadn't looked at this one yet. And this is the one that has the most information about deities and demigods. Now, the thing that most people would be likely to ask about deities and demigods is the Moorcock and Lovecraft copyright stuff. But that's not really what I'm interested in. I'm more interested in how Ward constructed the book. And he actually gives a little detail I think that's really interesting. He said that, of course, as we know, this is an attempt to update a previous work for an earlier edition of D&D. He says, "I was a history and English teacher in Prairie du Chien at the time with a family of three young boys and a pleasant wife. I wrote all of the material for the book during one summer vacation in 1979. In those days, there wasn't the internet. I had my own reference books from the last time I designed the Pantheons, and I spent more hours and hours in the library, again taking notes and ordering books from other libraries. I wanted to add more value to the new work than what was in the first Pantheon version." And he says the hardest section to write was the Cthulhu mythology. And he actually is really interesting, so if you are interested in the history of the book, I would go and check out this article. He goes on to say, "Gary gave me a format to use that was much like a monster manual listing. That was fine with me as it gave me an order and focus for each listing. I was given 1,000 pieces of photocopied sheets. I put each one in my non-electric typewriter and I typed up the deities, monsters, heroes, and other things of the Pantheon. In the creation of each pantheon, I made a list of deities, placed an imagined value on their power and influence. This caused me to list them as greater or lesser deities." And then he goes on about how they're organized. But I think the idea that it's kind of he did this by filling in forms is really interesting and maybe not completely surprising. You can see how in a pre-desktop publishing age, this would be a really useful tool. It did kind of have the effect of sometimes meaning that the format doesn't fit the deity that Ward is writing about, but he's kind of stuck with it for the sake of consistency. But yeah, so it's a really interesting insight into the creation of the Deities and Demigods book. If you're interested in the history of D&D, I recommend that you check it out. And if I remember, I'll try to put a link in the show notes. So thanks again, Glenn. Listener Eric Talvola, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your last name, Eric, also pointed this post out to me, and thank you for that as well. And I hope that those of you who go and read the article enjoy it. Okay, I'm hoping to cover three deities in today's episode, and these are two deities from Aztec or Mexica religion, and one from the mythology of the Maya people. So let's get started. As I said before, stipulating that I don't know that Central American mythos is a very good way to approach this section, I think, you know, Ward gave a good amount of detail about the first deity in the listing, Quetzalcoatl. For the most part, I think these listings are pretty good, but we're now going to talk about one that I'm not so convinced by, and that is Camachtli. Camachtli does reinforce the idea that this is Central American mythology, because he's not actually a terribly important figure to the Aztecs, or to the Mexica, perhaps I should say. He is a figure who's present in the mythology of, you know, sort of northern and central Mexico, but he's not particularly important to the Aztecs. Ward identifies him as a god of fate, which doesn't feel right to me at all. Camachtli is a war god, he's a god of hunting, and he's a celestial god associated with the Milky Way. What's interesting about Camachtli is that he is the father of the principal Aztec god, Huitzilopochtli. Hang on, James, I hear you say Quetzalcoatl is the principal god. Well, not really. If you were trying to establish like a shared pantheon for Maya and Aztec culture, Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan, because he appears in both of them, would be an important figure. But for the Aztecs specifically, the god Huitzilopochtli was sort of their patron deity. And Camachtli, or Mixcoatl, as he's sometimes called, or perhaps maybe even more commonly called, doesn't really appear to the same extent as a deity like Huitzilopochtli. In fact, I'm looking through my copy of the Codex Borgia, which is a an Aztec codex full of calendrical and mythological information, and Mixcoatl appears only once, and the notes here that I have gloss him as the old god of the heavens. So there's a suggestion there maybe that Mixcoatl or Comaxtli was a more important figure before the cult of Huitzilopochtli displaced him. And that's consistent with some of the other information that I have, which is that Comaxtli, or Mixcoatl, was particularly important to the people of Tlaxcala. I've mentioned before that the Aztec quote-unquote empire was really a network of allied or subjugated city-states, headed by the so-called Triple Alliance, the three cities of Tenochtitlan, Tlacopan, and Texcoco. And one of the major city-states that was not part of this alliance was Tlaxcala. And if you take a look at the map of the Aztec Empire, you'll see that Tlaxcala and its hinterland are, in fact, completely surrounded by the Aztecs. They have no access to the Gulf of Mexico other than through Aztec territory, and yet they're holding out. And the British Museum's book, Moctezuma and the Aztecs, describes the Tlaxcalan as fearless, which I guess you'd have to be. So, I mean, that makes sense, I suppose, that the Tlaxcalan community would not venerate Huitzilopochtli, the patron deity of their strategic enemies. So, you know, maybe there we see the preservation of an older practice of venerating Comaxtli or Mixcoatl. He is often depicted as a hunter or warrior, shown with a shield or with arrows. He has a special arrow or harpoon that he hunts with, and that's another characteristic of Huitzilopochtli, who is a warlike god. So I don't know where all this stuff about Comaxtli being the god of fate comes from. It's not in any of the sources I can find, but that's also, he's barely mentioned. Our next deity is also one that doesn't necessarily appear in a whole lot of sources, but on the other hand, it's a humdinger when he does, and that's Kamazots. Sots means bat in Quiche Maya, which is the language that the Maya epic, the Popol Vuh, is written in. And in that, Kamazots appears as a threat during the hero twins Xpalanque and Hunapu. They're journeying through Xibalba, the underworld, and they go into this place called the Bat House, and there they encounter Kamazots. There are two possible origins for the name Kamazots. Probably the one that seems to be most widely accepted is that, well, Sots means bat, and Kama means death. So, for example, one, the kind of villain, question mark, of the Popol Vuh is called Hun Kame, One Death. So it means death bat, which is pretty great. It's also possible that it comes from a slightly different root, and it means something like snatch bat or frightening bat, that it comes from a word that means something like fright or surprise attack, at least according to the translation of the Popol Vuh that I'm reading, which is by Dennis Tedlock. And another source cited by Tedlock, Domingo de Boceta, calls a creature with a similar name, quote, an animal that eats the moon. So this is a pretty great bat creature, and the description of the encounter is pretty good too. So I'm going to quote from the Popol Vuh, translated by Dennis Tedlock. Now they were put inside Bat House, with bats alone inside the house, a house of snatch bats, monstrous beasts, their snouts like knives, the instruments of death. To come before these is to be finished off at once. When they were inside, they just slept in their blowgun. They were not bitten by the members of the household. But this is where they gave one of themselves up, because of a snatch bat that came down. He came along just as one of them showed himself. They did it because it was actually what they were asking for, what they had in mind. And all night, the bats are making noise. Eek, 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 they say, and they say it all the night. Then it let up a little. The bats were no longer moving around. So there, one of the boys crawled to the end of the blowgun, since Xpalanque said, Hunapu, can you see how long it is till dawn? Well, perhaps I should look to see how long it is, he replied. So he kept trying to look out the muzzle of the blowgun. He tried to see the dawn. And then his head was taken off by a snatch bat, leaving Hunapu's body still stuffed inside. What's going on? Hasn't it dawned? Said Xpalanque. No longer is there any movement from Hunapu. What's this? Hunapu hasn't left, has he? What have you done? He no longer moves. Now there is only heavy breathing. So anyway, the head is taken off for a bunch of deities or monsters to go play ball with, but not to worry, Xpalanque makes his brother a replacement head, and then the adventure continues from there. And there's more about the head and the ball game, and it's all terrific, but The Popol Vuh is pretty wild. Xibalba, incidentally, would make a fantastic, not a dungeon, it's a mega dungeon, it's a sort of dungeon dimension, full of different themed rooms, each of them full of different monsters or dangers. I'm sure someone's already done it, and if they haven't, they ought to have. But so that's Kamisatz. I mean, we don't know that much about Kamisatz, and over the last few weeks, this article about Kamisatz has been circulating on the internet about how, like, oh yeah, you know, there was a Batman in Maya civilization, based on this very cool Kamisatz Batman sculpture made as part of an art exhibit in Mexico. But if you read it, you'll see there's this very little about Kamisatz, and just a lot about bats in general, and in particular about the theory that Kamisatz was inspired by a particular species of vampire bat that may have lived longer than scientists think and coexist with humans. I mean, maybe it did, who knows, and frankly, who cares in this context. So that's Kamisatz, great spooky bat deity, and I like the image of the bat, snipping off someone's head. That's in an OSR dungeon, isn't it? I recall listening to an episode of the excellent Fear of a Black Dragon podcast that included bats yanking people's heads off. So maybe that was a covert nod to Maya mythology. That'd be cool. So Kamashtli, a little bit, you know, you can get some inspiration from Kamashtli in terms of how to structure the relationships between different deities and different communities in your game. That's fine. But Kamisatz just fits into a fantasy game with no problem as a spooky underworld bat deity who will snip your head off if he feels like it. And Maya representations of Kamisatz are terrific with his knife-like nose. There's one image of a bat that's reproduced in my copy of the Popol Vuh that includes images on its wings that are intended to represent gouged out eyes. And you can't say fairer than that. Finally, we come to Chalchiutlique. That's the goddess of water. Her name means a jade skirt or precious green stone skirt. You may realize that this name resembles that of the inexplicably not included in this section Mexica mother goddess Coatlique, whose name means snake skirt or she of the snake skirt. Chalchiutlique is a very important deity in Aztec and sort of Mexican mythology generally. She is the goddess of flowing water, and she's the wife or possibly sister of the rain god Tlaloc. So basically, they're two halves of the water god. He represents rain falling from the sky, and she represents flowing water on the ground in streams and rivers and so forth. And she is one of the four deities who was responsible for one of the four previous ages of the world. You remember that I said that this is the fifth sun, and there were four previous worlds, one ruled or created by Quetzalcoatl, one by Tezcatlipoca, one by Tlaloc, and one by Chalchiutlique. And it's very possible I'm mispronouncing that name. So she's quite an important deity. She appears frequently in mythological texts like the Codex Borgia. And she's not only associated with water, but also with, she seems to have been a patron deity of childbirth and of midwives. We know that there are prayers said by midwives that focus on Chalchiutlique. To give you some impression of how important Chalchiutlique and Tlaloc were in Aztec society, there were five major religious festivals throughout the year dedicated to these two gods, out of a total of about 20. So, I mean, they're pretty significant. And of course, this makes sense because we're dealing with an agrarian society. Rain and flowing water and irrigation, you know, were crucial to the Aztec Empire's ability to feed its growing population. I mean, that's a serious, like, growing population-wise, just so we're clear what I'm talking about, Tenochtitlan, at the time of the conquest, had a population of something like 200,000 people. It was on par with big European cities. That's a major food production challenge, and obviously steady supplies of water are important to that. I mentioned her involvement in childbirth. That's accompanying the washing of the child immediately after it's delivered. So again, because Chalchiutlique is a deity of water, she's associated with this kind of ritual washing. And that's in Bernardo de Sahagún's writing about Aztec culture. So this is, again, shortly after the conquest, these rituals are being written down. So this is a pretty good collection of deities. We've got a kind of rival former supreme deity now dwindled, at least within the Aztec world, to a minor deity. We've got a spooky subterranean nighttime underworld deity who challenges the heroes of a mythical quest and snips one of their heads off. And we've got a life-giving nature deity who, you know, through that life-giving power is associated with another aspect of life-giving. So that's a pretty good spread, I think. Now, I mentioned before that I think it's really weird that there's no Coatlicue here. And maybe this, more than any other section, has some real odd omissions. You will be if you know anything about Aztec mythology, you will be astounded to learn that we're not getting Xipe Totec in this section, unless you want to include Xipe Totec with the idea of that Xipe Totec is like an aspect of Tezcatlipoca. He's one of the four Tezcatlipocas, but I don't think that's the same thing. Anyway, we're going to get into some more Aztec and Maya deities, including Huehueteotl, the god of fire, and the aforementioned Aztec patron deity Huitzilopochtli, the butterfly god of war, in our next episode. So please join me then for patron deities. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.